Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kathy Bennett Warner, Communications Director of the Corrett Foundation, and your chair for this evening's program. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download our iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. Tonight's program is part of the Commonwealth Club's American Values series, underwritten by the Corrett and Toby Family Foundations. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished speaker, David Stockman, former budget director under President Ronald Reagan and author of the new book, The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. David Stockman was elected as a Michigan congressman in 1976 and joined the Reagan White House in 1981. Serving as budget director, he was one of the key architects of the Reagan Revolution plan to reduce taxes, cut spending, and shrink the role of government. He joined Solomon Brothers in 1985 and later became one of the early partners of the Blackstone Group. During nearly two decades at Blackstone and at a firm he founded, Heartland Industrial Partners, Mr. Stockman was a private equity investor. Born in Fort Hood, Texas, Mr. Stockman attended Michigan State University and Harvard Divinity School and then went to Washington as a congressional aide in 1970. In his new book, The Great Deformation, Mr. Stockman describes how the working of free markets and democracy has long been under threat in America and provides a surprising catalog of the corruptors and defenders. His analysis overturns the assumptions of Keynesians and monetarists alike, demonstrating his view that both liberal and neoconservative interference in markets has proved damaging and often dangerous. Mr. Stockman says that over time, crony capitalism has made fools of us all, transforming Republican Treasury secretaries into big government interventionists and populist Democrat presidents into industry-wrecking internationalists. Please join me in welcoming David Stockman.
Well, thank you for going through my whole resume so that now everyone is clear that I've never held a steady job during my entire life. Nevertheless, I really am gratified, I have to say this, and pleased that so many people came out tonight to hear about my book. Because the word has been out now for over a week that I'm not a real author. I basically do rants and screeds and become unhinged from time to time. And according to Professor Paul Krugman, actually the whole thing is just the rant of a cranky old man. So, actually I was a cranky young man my whole life and I never got over it. But in any event, when he said that, after the summary of the book appeared in the New York Times about a week ago, the book went straight up the list, and the only thing that stopped it was three diet books and something called The Walking Dead. So then I realized I was in the right zip code, because to be real honest about this, this is about the diet we're going to go on as a nation, I think, for quite a while, because we have had such bad policy, this massive buildup of debt, public and private, for 30 years now. The Fed has been turned into a bubble machine, and I'll talk about that. We have prosperity on Wall Street. We have, real desperation on Main Street, and it's not getting any better. But I did notice when I go to various events, and even tonight, someone was looking apprehensively at the girth of this book. And I will admit, that it weighs 2 pounds. However, the good news tonight is I think it can be, the 700 pages can be boiled down to 7 words. Do not believe Washington or Wall Street. And by that, I essentially mean that we have a vast disconnect between the reality that's going on in the real economy, let's call it the Main Street of America, from coast to coast, and the dialogue that goes on inside the Beltway and on the other end of I-95 on in Wall Street. And what I think has happened over the last several decades, and the book is really all about this and develops it sort of decade by decade, decision by decision, critical event by event, that we have had the rise of something that I call crony capitalism, which unfortunately is the worst of both worlds. It really undermines the notion of a free market economy that can generate tremendous growth and investment and productivity and rising living standards and more wealth, and a political democracy, which we have always believed and cherished in this country and believed for a long time that we had still functioning. But I think I can show you, or at least we develop in the book, and I'll give a few summary lines on that tonight, is that that has been really deformed, and that's where I get the title of the book, as a result of things that we've been doing for several decades now that violate my three principles. One, fiscal rectitude. I think you can't borrow forever like we're doing now and lay it off all onto the next generation and leave them with the bills and leave them with huge tax payments to cover the interest on all this debt that we're creating. I don't think you can have a Federal Reserve that prints as much money as it's doing now, showers it onto Wall Street. Most of it stays in the canyons of Wall Street. It helps the speculators. It helps the gamblers. But it really doesn't get into productive investment in our private economy. So what I want to say tonight is that we have a fundamental breakdown or failure in all three of the important components of our system. The political parties, in my judgment, have really failed. And if you look at what's happening now, and political parties used to be important in democracy, but if you look at what's happening now in Washington, I would say the political parties have become glorified concierges. And basically, their job is to introduce politicians to money and to PACs and to K Streets to help them get reelected. Both parties do it. Both parties profess various kinds of platforms and ideological goals and so forth, but really when push comes to shove, they don't stand for anything. Now, I've come from the conservative side, the Republican side, but I am really mortified to say the Republicans don't stand anymore when they make decisions, not when they give speeches. I mean, you know, we have our Lincoln Day dinners and so forth, and you can hear all the grand rhetoric you want about how we can't live beyond our means, the government's too big, we've got to shrink the beast and all of this. But what they've done when they've been in power in the last two decades has been nearly the opposite. After all, who bailed out Wall Street? Who bailed out AIG? Who started the bailout of the auto industry and GM? It was a Republican White House. It violated all the rules of the free market. It violated the principle that if you make errors, if you make mistakes, if you have failure, then the consequences have to unfold, or you can't have a private economy that's productive and healthy. You will get moral hazard. You will get everyone thinking you can swing for the fences, you can leverage yourself, you can take big risks, and if somehow things don't work out and you run into failure, they're going to come and put a safety net under you, and particularly this happened in Wall Street. So here's the Republican Party doing that. Here's the Republican Party running huge deficits in peacetime during the Bush era, and I'm not particularly trying to pick on him. I could find other areas, administrations to talk about, but running huge peacetime deficits, unfinanced wars, two of them that we never should have had, two huge tax cuts that, you know, tax cuts are fine if you cut spending by the same amount and are willing to pay your bills. None of that happened. Now, you're going to say, why are you being so hard on the Republicans? I don't have to be hard on the Democrats. They're hard on themselves in terms of, you know, some of the things that they tell you. And I have many, many things to say about that in the book. And if you look at my heroes and villains, I don't say this in a personal sense, but in a policy sense, who made the big right decisions over time, you know, since the 1950s or even going back sooner? Who made the wrong decisions? You can look at my list. I sort of have 18 on either side. And it's pretty much a mix of Republicans and Democrats. For instance, my heroes start with Calvin Coolidge. And, of course, this drives the Keynesians nuts and all the people who think that we're actually on the right track with this constant, you know, stimulus to the economy and deficit spending and a Fed that's really out of control. But I also go through the middle period of the decade, or the century, and talk about Eisenhower and what a fantastic president he really was, retrospectively, because he actually balanced the budget 4 times out of 8. Nobody's come close. If you take his entire 8 years, the average deficit was 0.5% of GDP. Well, today, if they get 0.5% of GDP deficit, they would say, hallelujah, you know, salvation has come. They can't even get close to that where we are today. But more than that, Eisenhower was a war hero who said the Defense Department is a danger if we let it get out of control, if we let the budget get too big, if we allow the military-industrial complex to have too much influence in the legislative process and in the policy equation. And unbelievably, Eisenhower cut the defense budget in today's dollars. And I'd like to put everything in today's dollars because then the numbers might make sense to you. He cut it from $530 billion when he entered office that was left by Truman after the Korean War to $370 billion. That is by 30%. By basically saying we're going to cut back the war machine of the United States to only what we need to deal with the real Soviet threat, the real Soviet nuclear threat, but we're not going to have a big land force. We're not going to have the capability to engage in wars of invasion and occupation because that's not where our national interest lies. And so the reason I mention this is that he was the last president who actually tamed the Pentagon. He was the last president who actually stood up to the military-industrial complex, cut the defense budget in today's dollars to under $400 billion. Now they're down there today having a big fight about whether the defense budget should be $650 billion or $620 billion, same dollars, same purchasing power, nearly 80% more than Eisenhower thought was necessary to deal with a real enemy, the Soviet Union, that still had an economy that functioned. Here we are today. Some people in the Beltway haven't got the memo. The Cold War ended in 1990. The Soviet Union is no more. Russia has become a kleptocracy, which is far more interested in stealing from each other than they are impinging on their neighbors. The only other industrial economy that could even mount a threat to us is the red capitalist miracle of China. And obviously, they're the biggest export machine in the world. They're the Nike and Apple capital of the world. They desperately need markets for all this stuff they're making. Are they going to bomb 3,000 Walmarts in America? I think not. So the point that I'm making here is that this is a bipartisan issue. I started out, and the book is about a lot more than defense and the welfare state and what a great hero Eisenhower was. But the reason I'm talking about it is that way back in 1967 when I was in college, and I can see there's probably a couple people out here who were also in college in 1967, I cut my eye teeth politically protesting the war in Vietnam, marching on the Pentagon, and wondering what in the world are we doing in Southeast Asia in the jungles, not dropping napalm from the sky against people who couldn't possibly harm the United States. Well, they had all these theories then of the domino and all the domino theory and all of that, but we know today that that was nonsense. We know that in 1961, 2, and 3, when this thing was escalated, the people in China were starving in their villages because Mao's wonderful theory of collectivizing agriculture and turning everybody into a backyard steelmaker was destroying his economy. They'd lost 40 million people to starvation in China at the time we were invading Vietnam to stop the Chinese from coming across the border. They couldn't get across the border. They were starving, okay? So when we look at the history of this, one of the great problems we still have in 2013 is we're a much older society now. The baby boom is heading towards retirement. We now have a $17 trillion national debt. It was $1 trillion when I started with Reagan. And we still have a war machine in place that makes no sense. Now, the reason I mentioned about being an anti-war protester is that in my original foray in life, I worked for the peace candidate in 1968. And the peace candidate was Bobby Kennedy, and he didn't make it through the campaign. Then there was Gene McCarthy, and he got shunted aside. And the point I'm making is that now, finally, in 2008, 40 years later, the peace candidate finally won. Obama won the election. He had a huge mandate. Enough of these wars. What they were telling you about Iraq, we're going to win the hearts and minds of the people, is the same thing I heard when I was a kid in 1965, that all we were going to do is win the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese people by destroying their villages and other things. And we knew that that didn't make any sense then, and here we're doing it again. Same thing in Afghanistan. But anyway, the peace candidate finally wins in 1968, and the peace candidate... what does he do? He ends up increasing the defense budget even beyond this huge level that it was left at by George Bush, and setting it at 80% higher than what Eisenhower, the real general that we ever had in the White House, said was necessary. What I say in my book is that this is the power of the military-industrial complex, that Obama had a mandate and he beat his plowshares into a mightier sword. Now, I think the Old Testament said you're supposed to beat your sword into a plowshare, but he got it backwards. Now, why do I pick so hard, you know, trying to introduce my book on the military-industrial complex and this whole issue of the defense budget, which is only part of it? The reason I do is that it's an illustration of the power of crony capitalism. We are running this massive military budget today because it's a jobs program, because the defense contractors have to have another fighter, brand new fighter, modern fighter, when we have nobody to use it on anywhere in the world. That they have to continue to have a 11-carrier battle group Navy when no one else in the world even has a Navy with two carrier battle groups. In fact, some of you may be interested to know that China... even though they couldn't possibly attack us because they would destroy their economy if they did, but China has one aircraft carrier battle group, aircraft carrier. Now, where did they get that aircraft carrier? Well, they bought it used from the Ukraine, all right? And where did the Ukraine get it? Well, they stole it from the Soviet Union when the whole evil empire supposedly collapsed. So this is why we're maintaining, at a cost of billions and tens of billions a year, 11 aircraft carrier battle groups. And that's just not the carrier. It's got all the planes and all the escort ships and all the electronics and so forth. It is really kind of a madness. And I think it's easy sometimes for people to see that if they're this far off base on the defense issues, on national security, if they're this subservient to the military-industrial complex, then what do we say about the tax code? I say it's the same thing. For the last 20 years or so, the tax code has been written by the K Street lobbyists. And the reason it's a loophole-riddled embarrassment, disgrace, is that it is controlled lock, stock, and barrel by one pack and one interest group after another. And unfortunately, my Republican colleagues, and I'm a lapsed Republican now, as some of you might tell by what I'm saying, but my Republican colleagues got hooked on the idea that fiscal rectitude is no longer important. Remember, Cheney said deficits don't matter, and those are some of the worst words ever spoken, in the Beltway by a Republican, I think. But they got so hooked on the idea, let's not worry about the deficit, let's cut taxes, that they basically turned K Street into the tax-cutting department of the United States. And they just chiseled away and riddled the thing with loopholes, unfairness, and things that make no sense. The one great thing that Ronald Reagan did when he left office before he left office was the Tax Reform Act of 1986. And that actually leveled the playing field, and it said all kinds of income will be taxed the same. Capital gains, carried interest, dividends, interest, wage and salary, the bus driver, and the Wall Street speculator were all going to pay 28% uniform rate at the top. Where we got after the 1990s and then the Republican tax-cutting department taking control of things during the Bush era is that we got the ordinary rate up to 39%, and we got the capital gains rate all the way down to 15%. And that created such a unlevel playing field, such a huge gap, that the tax lawyers and the accountants and the whole financial system became oriented towards loading up companies with debt in order to use that debt to pay down cash flow, to use the cash flow to pay debt. That was tax deductible, and then after a couple years, sell the thing, take a capital gain, pay only 15%, and move on to the next levered deal. So our whole tax code is now basically deformed. It doesn't generate very much revenue. We have the lowest revenue, you know, in the last 30 or 40 years as a percent of GDP. But worse, it channels activity into ways and means and nooks and crannies of the economy that are determined not by the free market and by supply and demand and risk and all the other things that they give speeches about, but by the tax code and what the K Street lobbyists have been able to get in. So as we have all of this going on, we have a private economy that's beginning to falter under the weight of these big budget deficits coming out of Washington and the massive money creation that's coming out of the Fed. And it is beginning to undermine seriously, in my view, the Main Street economy. We could talk about it for a long time, but I want to give just one number, because you may have seen the employment report last Friday that I think begins to suggest how far different the reality is from what's reported in the monthly and weekly economic reports and news. I call them seasonally maladjusted noise, okay? Because you have to look at the trend, and the trend is more than the last 30 days or the last couple weeks or even the last quarter. And if we look at the trend since 2000, and the reason I picked 2000 is that is the last time that the S&P 500 was about where it is today. And although they're all celebrating today that the market's at an all-time high, we were here 4,750 days ago. Now, for all of you doing long division, divide by 365, carry the 10, and that's 13 years, okay? But think about that. In the last 13 years, we've been at this level three times. And we had the crash, the dot-com crash, $5 trillion of 401ks and wealth were wiped out. Then they reflated the bubble with 1% interest rate. We had the housing bubble. We had the Wall Street bubble, the credit bubble, the LBOs, and then it crashed again in the meltdown in 2008, and $7 trillion was blown away. So the reason I'm mentioning this is they've reflated the bubble. We're back here for the third time, but where has the real economy, the Main Street economy, gone during that same period? The answer is, if we measured unemployment today the same way we did in March 2000, this last time we were at this level on the S&P 500, about 1550, a little more, the unemployment rate today would be 13%, not 7.6, whatever was reported. And the reason for that is that today there are 27 million people not in the workforce holding jobs who are of adult age that would have been holding jobs in the workforce at the participation rate that existed in the year 2000. In other words, people are dropping out of our economy in vast numbers. And, of course, the defenders of the status quo say, hey, your number is misleading. It's not 13%. Everybody's retiring. And if you adjust for demographics, none of that would be true. I say, okay, let's look at the numbers. And when you look at the numbers, you see that in that 13-year period now, March 2000 to today, the number of people on Social Security old age retirement is up 6 million. The number of people who are of working age not holding jobs is up 27 million. What happened to the other 21 million? I think they vanished into the black hole of our failing Main Street economy and the bubble economics of boom and bust that have been created by the Federal Reserve. They're on food stamps. They're on disability. Or they're just scraping by day to day, trying to hold body and soul together. Or they've moved in with mom and pop if they're kids. Or if they're older and have no other income, they've moved in with their sons and daughters. In other words, the Main Street economy isn't growing. Less than 1.7% a year for the last 13 years, the lowest since the Civil War for that span of time. The middle, the average real median income in this country, not average, the median real income in this country, measuring the Main Street family is down 8%. If you take the bottom 90% of households in America, their net worth has declined 25% since 2000. So my argument is huge things are going wrong in the real economy, and all of this stimulus you hear about in this 1% or 0% interest rate and this massive expansion of the Fed's balance sheet. Back in 2000, it was $500 billion. It took 94 years to get there. Today, it's $3.2 trillion, and they're expanding it by $100 billion a month. Now, did this do any good for Main Street? It couldn't have. You heard some of the statistics I gave. But it's done wonders for Wall Street because it fuels constant speculation and constant carry trades and arbitrages and leverages. And I use one example, and I call it the granny trade versus the Goldman Sachs trade. And the granny trade works like this. If you were a prudent American family in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and you spent a lifetime trying to be prudent, frugal, save, maybe not buying a new car every year, or maybe not upgrading your kitchen or whatever, and you were able to save $100,000 over a working lifetime, and you're now retired on that $100,000, you know how much Ben Bernanke has decided you're entitled to earn as interest because he's doing it for the greater good of our economy? You are making, if you put it in a CD, a 0.5%, actually 0.4, and that means you're making $400 a year on a lifetime of savings, and this policy is not from the free market. It's not from the supply and demand for short-term money. It is a rate set by the Fed through its massive operations in the market day in and day out in its huge bond buying. Now, if we had to put that proposition to the Congress, do you think that we ought to be crushing the savers of America? Do you think we ought to be telling Granny that she can only make $400 on a lifetime of savings? It would be laughed out of court. It would never get a vote. But we have the Fed doing it because the Fed is basically functioning as the Monetary Politburo of the United States. It runs everything. There are no interest rates that are real left in the market. The stock market trades because they think the Fed is going to keep injecting liquidity, or what I say, monetary cocaine, into the system. Now, compare the granny trade with the Goldman Sachs trade. Today, Goldman Sachs could go, or tomorrow, down and buy $1 billion worth of treasury bonds, 10-year bonds, that yield 1.8%, and immediately put them up as collateral. Just put it down, right here's the billion, borrow in the repo market, which is the overnight short-term market that you can get on Wall Street, $980 million, in other words, almost all of it, and pay 0.1% interest on the borrowed money. So if you're earning 1.7% and you're paying nothing, the spread is huge. In fact, if you want to know the number, it's $50,000 a day for doing nothing except putting on the spread. And you'd say, yeah, but they're taking risk. And the answer is no, they're not taking any risk because the Fed and Bernanke said, we're going to keep the overnight rate, our thumb on the scale, it's zero or 10 basis points until 2015. And on the other hand, we're not going to let the price of that asset you own, the $1 billion that you bought on leverage, we're not going to let that drop for a second because we're going to buy hand over fist. That's what the $85 billion of monthly purchases of bonds is doing. In other words, the Fed is managing entirely the whole range of interest rates, creating spreads, creating arbitrages and trades that basically are being captured by traders and fast money, hedge funds, and so forth. And that is all where that's where the money goes. It's not going into Main Street because Main Street has got too much debt already, and we don't need low interest rates. Now, I have many other things in the book about how crony capitalism has perverted everything. The last one I'll mention is the great, development that occurred. I guess I could think of some stronger words, but then I realized this is a public meeting, so I didn't say those words. But the bailout of Wall Street in September 2008 was utterly unnecessary, completely wrong. It set precedents that are going to live for time immemorial. and it basically undermined any sense of financial discipline and responsibility that we have in our society. And I show in the book that there were only, this wasn't going to be Great Depression 2.0. This wasn't going to spread to the rest of the economy, and there's a lot of detail that we could go through on that. You know, AIG, when they bailed it out with $185 billion, was not a contagious financial disease that was going to spread around the country. They could have put it in bankruptcy. All the bad paper that AIG had issued was at the holding company. The holding company could have been bankrupted. All the insurance subsidiaries, whether they were life insurance or property and casualty, all of those were regulated by state insurance commissioners. No one could have raided them for cash or money, and so no insurance policyholder was ever at risk. But anyway, the panic basically occurred on the third floor of the Treasury building, which was occupied by Goldman Sachs. That is, Hank Paulson and all the, you know, Goldmanites that he had running around in there. I call it the BlackBerry Panic of 2008 because they were all running around. I don't have a BlackBerry anymore. I've switched to iPhone recently. But they were all running around looking at their BlackBerries, seeing the price of Goldman or the price of Morgan Stanley or the price of the S&P 500 or some other trades dropping by the hour, and concluded the world was ending, and therefore anything and everything that could be done to stop it cold right now should be done. Even though, if you look at it carefully, there would have been no negative effect. If Goldman had gone under, that could have been reorganized. There's a lot of talent there. There would be five sons of Goldman today, but they would be a lot more prudent if they went through the proper course of bankruptcy and had lost money because they were gambling houses and the behavior never changed. Well, there's a lot more about the BlackBerry Panic in the book. But I will say that we had it, and then here we are 5 years later, and nothing's been done about it. If those banks were too big to fail, which they weren't, that's all urban legend, that's the propaganda that came from the Goldman Sachs occupation of the Treasury building. I call it a financial coup d'etat. I mean, Bush was sitting in the White House clueless. He had no idea what was going on. And when he finally called in the congressional leaders, he said, Hank Paulson's going to tell you why we're in big trouble, but I'm told this sucker's going down. So that was kind of the sum and substance of what he knew about it. And then he said, and so therefore we're going to have to do anything and everything, so I'm going to set aside the free market rules in order to save the free market. And there were many other pearls of wisdom along those lines that came out at that time. So there we were with too big to fail, causing every rule known of prudence, of financial responsibility, of the way the free market is supposed to work being set aside. And now, today, the big banks are even bigger than they were then. The Dodd-Frank is just a regulatory pettifoggery exercise that no one can figure out. There's hundreds of studies being made. The language is so rubbery that the big banks will work around it. But my simple prescription in the book is super Glass-Steagall. If they're too big to fail, they're too big to exist. Break them up and make our economy, our financial system, a little safer. Second, if you want to have the privileges of the state, and remember, banks aren't free enterprises. They're wards of the state. If they didn't have deposit insurance, if they didn't have the right when they get in trouble to go to the window of the Fed and get the free stuff, you know, the cheap money that nobody else in our economy can get, they wouldn't be nearly the size they are today. And yet here we are, and we have the top, six banks with nearly $10 trillion worth of asset footings, more than they had before. We have the leading bank having a little scandal last spring, as you remember, called the London Whale Trade. And now that's all being investigated. But the interesting thing that comes out of the investigations and some of the stuff that came out of the congressional committees is there was a huge debate in the email chatter, and this is great, when they do investigations, all the emails come out, among the top leaders running this great bank, debating whether this was a hedge or a speculation. Now, when you lose $6 billion and you're not sure whether you were speculating or hedging, then I say they are too big to exist because they're too dangerous to manage. And so therefore, there has to be fundamental reform. But at the end of the day, the problem is the Fed. You do not realize how much money they're creating that's staying in Wall Street and creating and maintaining and sustaining this speculative game. If you went back to 1990 and you rounded up 100 economists of all different persuasions and Republican, Democrat, not one in 500, in my judgment, I was there. You know, I've been around there that long, 1990, way back. Not one in 500 would have said the Fed can be buying $85 billion a month, expanding its balance sheet at $1 trillion a year. In fact, during the heat of the panic, the Fed was actually increasing its balance sheet, which means printing money. It's the same thing. If the balance sheet expands, new assets, how did you pay for them? You printed money by hitting the send button on their digital money machine. The Fed was printing money at $700 million per hour. That's what was going on. And it never helped the economy because we've had a small bounce back, but we're basically at the same point we were, as I say, several times in the last decade. You keep hearing about the job report. Last Friday they said 88,000 new jobs. Well, the newsflash on that is those are born-again jobs. And by born-again jobs, I mean, and people, because of the short-run nature of all the reporting and the headlines, which then the robots on Wall Street trade, the fact is the first time we had 135.2 million non-farm payroll jobs, the number they reported Friday, was in the spring of 2005. All right, those jobs were already there once. We had the bubble expansion in the housing boondoggle and the boom up through 2007. All those jobs disappeared, and now we're crawling back. And every job that you've heard that's been recreated since, that's been a new job since the bottom in 1990 is simply since the bottom in 2009 is simply a born-again job that we had once and we lost, and we're treading water is what I'm saying. So therefore, there are huge problems in this economy. The kind of policies that we're following aren't succeeding. The system is becoming more unstable. We're having repeated boom and bust cycles. We have a serial bubble machine at the Fed that is essentially captive to Wall Street. And all of this is coming together in a way that I think is very concerning, very alarming, and it's off the charts in terms of anything we've ever experienced historically. So that's why I had the title on my piece called Sundown America. I'm not trying to be a doom and gloomer, but I'm saying the private economy is being asphyxiated, is being suffocated by the massive game playing and bubble economics that are running both out of Wall Street and out of Washington. Unless there's radical change, we're going to be in fairly big trouble as we move down the road. Now, I had in the 712 pages, 699 pages of diagnosis like this, and 13 pages of solutions. But I will say that these are some of the high points. There are many more. I said Eisenhower was one of the heroes. Volcker was one. He did a great job, but then they threw him out once he got inflation down. Even Sheila Bair, a Republican appointee, stood up to the Bailsters, the Goldmanites, and basically she was running FDIC, and they shutted her off to the side and said, keep quiet. We're going to do what we need to do. So anyway, there's a lot of history as to how all this evolved over decades. But I think right now, since I pretty well covered chapter one, that I'll stop and we'll go into the questions. Thank you all very much.
Our thanks to David Stockman, former budget director under President Ronald Reagan, and author of the new book, The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. I'm Evelyn Dilsaver, a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, and your moderator for tonight's audience question period. And we have a lot of questions, so I'll have to go through that. But just as a reminder, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, And our guest today is David Stockman, former budget director under President Reagan, who's discussing his views on threats to the free market and American democracy. And you can find a video of the Commonwealth Club programs online at Fora TV. Okay, so one of the first questions I have is, you mentioned that the too big to fail, and there are two lawmakers today that introduced in the LA Times a proposal to break up the big banks. And then the Treasury has 90 days in which to do it after they've determined which ones are too big to fail. What do you think about that? Is that a step in the right direction?
Yeah, I think it is. Now, it sounds draconian, but our financial system is so much at risk. It's so fragile. We've gone through two or three of these busts over the last 15 years, starting back in 1998 when they bailed out long-term capital, that you have to take extreme action. Now, the part of the reason is the bank lobbying forces, the Wall Street lobbying forces, are so powerful that instead of doing that, they pass Dodd-Frank, which is hundreds of pages of kind of rubbery language that means nothing, an enabling act. It has now been in rulemaking for two or three years. It's still not clear what half of it means. It's all going to be litigated, challenged. Every clause, every comma is going to be twisted and reinterpreted. And so, therefore, the system festers. Nothing is done, and they fight in this puzzle palace of Dodd-Frank when we should be doing something drastic because it's the only solution. So what I say in my book is for the next 10 years, the big banks are under economic house arrest. And what I mean by that is they cannot use the earnings that they're making today. You know, they've rebuilt their earnings, and they say we're all healthy and our balance sheets are better. But where did they get the earnings? They got it out of the height of the American savers. Now, I'm not blaming the banks personally. The Fed made it possible for the banks of America to have $7 or $8 trillion worth of deposits on which they're paying almost nothing. They then turn those deposits into loans and into securities. They own $2 trillion worth of treasuries, by the way, in which they're earning 2%, and thanks to the Fed, they have to pay almost nothing for their deposits. So all of this money coming in is rebuilding their balance sheet on an accounting basis. Retained earnings are going up, and now they're demanding, this is why I get to the draconian solution, the right to use the cash that's coming in, which is essentially cash that's being squeezed out of the savers of America, to buy in their stock and pay dividends in order to boost the stock price, make the executive options worth more, and get back to the same old party that we were doing in before the crisis in 2008. I say no. If until we get this system really healthy and until we're in the clear, if you're building up earnings this way, and, you know, we got to reform the Fed too, but if you are, they stay sequestered on your balance sheet. You can't buy in stock. You can't pay dividends, build up a reserve, build up a cushion. So the next time we have a big spill or some kind of bubble implosion in the financial markets, you don't come running to the taxpayers because you're on the ragged edge. You've got a big cushion. Now, until we do that, we're going to have, I think, any time another crisis, but I further suggest that banks that are bigger than 1% of GDP, that's $150 billion, because that's 1% of GDP, are too big to exist, and we ought to put a cap on the size of banks at $150 billion. Now, they would scream about that because they would say we can't compete with the Europeans. But the European banks are just arms of the state. Do you think the French banks would last for, you know, more than a couple hours if the French government wasn't implicitly behind them? There's no way. Do you think Deutsche Bank, which is leveraged, you know, 35 to 1, Deutsche Bank has $4 trillion worth of assets and about $60 billion worth of equity. Do you think any of those European banks would last more than a few days in a real market if they weren't backed up by their governments? The answer is no. So why are the taxpayers and savers of America supposed to allow our banks to compete with the socialist banks of Europe for no particular reason? And that's the only excuse they ever come up with on why we shouldn't break them up and limit their size. So I say, if you think we can make America more prosperous by competing with the misguided governments of Europe and socialist banking in Europe, then I think you're wrong. What we need to do is what's right for our system. What we need to do is get our financial markets back into some kind of functioning free enterprise system. And that means if we cannot compete with the Europeans for subsidized business internationally, so be it. Why do we really want to if the cost is to allow these huge banks to continue? So Super Glass-Steagall, number one of many reforms that we need to get out of the mess that we're in.
Great, thank you.
Pardon?
We take questions from up
can
here.
I ask
sorry,
about capital,
sure.
Though, because that's a good one.
Sure.
You're saying if I say $150 billion for balance sheet, what should the capital level be? Well, they have all these things about 3%, 5%, 7% equity, and you hear about the Basel II and III. In part of my book, I go back in history and I say, you know something. We were pretty prosperous in the 1920s, and what was the average equity to asset ratio in banks in the 1920s? 20%. That's what banks historically had by way of equity. Banks historically had huge cash cushions up to 25% for the big money center banks, so that if there was a run on the bank, they had the ability to liquefy their depositors. Now, that's what we ought to have today. And if banks make less return on equity because they have more equity and less risk and less debt and, you know, funding, then so be it. We need to have a safe system, or otherwise every 4 or 5 years we're going to have another panic, and then we're going to have the bailout brigade in there throwing taxpayers in harm's way, and we're going to have the Fed, you know, opening up the fire hoses and doing all of the destructive things that it did last time. So the idea that everything's fixed, banks are healthy, the stock market is at an all-time high, I think is just part of the bubble illusion that we've been in for, you know, several decades now. Okay, now
thank you, David. Thanks. The critics, you've had a lot of controversy on the book, which has been great because it gets to people to talk, but your critics have said that you've changed your position. And so what is your personal journey that got you to believe what you believe today and in this book? Because you were with Blackstone, you did financial transactions,
right?
You were with Reagan.
Right.
What is it?
Well, in the 1980s, when I was a congressman, in 1976 to 80, I was a congressman, and I voted on many things, but the one that I'm most proud of is I voted against the first Chrysler bailout. All right, and I had an automotive district from Michigan. I had all kinds of supplier plants. I was one out of 19 congressmen in Michigan who voted against it. Lee Iacocca, as you remember, was the great salesman for Chrysler at the time. Denounced me as more severely than Krugman did last week. But I voted against it because I thought it was a violation of the rules of capitalism, and frankly, Chrysler should have gone down the first time. There's plenty of car companies. There's plenty of cars in the world. You did need Chrysler, and they bailed it out second and so forth. So one of the things I'm trying to say is I really haven't changed my position that much. When I was in the Reagan White House, I was for free markets, fiscal rectitude. I was in the group that believed we're going to cut spending and taxes, not just taxes and wait for miracles. And I was for sound money, which means I supported all the way what Volcker was doing to rid the economy of this terrible inflation that we had in the 70s. And we should have stayed with the Volcker package, with the Volcker policy, rather than put Greenspan in, who became the great enabler of bubble finance. So now what happened was over 20 years, 30 years, everything has drifted. Republicans gave up fiscal rectitude. They now said deficits don't matter. The Republicans gave up free markets. They said we're going to bail out Chrysler, AIG, and all the rest, as I have said. And the Republicans, and this grieves me greatly, the Republicans appointed all of the money printers to the Fed. I mean, it wasn't Jimmy Carter who appointed Alan Greenspan. Jimmy Carter appointed Volcker. He was the greatest Fed chairman we ever had. The Republicans, unfortunately, Ronald Reagan, in this case, he was a sound money man. He actually supported Volcker all the way through, and I give him credit. He did, and even though the White House staff, they were all saying, he's going to be the undoing the Republican Party, Ronald Reagan actually knew that the Fed had caused the inflation of the 70s and that cure had to be taken, even if it was painful. But by 1987, when the White House staff decided to drum Volcker out, which they did, they cut his knees off in a big decision in 1986, they presented Alan Greenspan as kind of a quasi-lapsed gold bug, from the days when he spent in the parlors of Ayn Rand. And the president thought he was really a sound money man, but he turned out, to be running a popularity contest or something, because he gave up, he abandoned everything he had earlier said, and that's why I have a chapter in my book called Greenspan 2.0. And I compare that to Greenspan 1.0, which was the Greenspan of sound money and even the gold standard prior to when he was appointed. Now, the reason I'm saying this is Republicans appointed him. Then they appointed Bernanke, who's even worse. Okay, Bernanke said before he was appointed that if push comes to shove, I will drop money from a helicopter. He actually said that. That could have been vetted. His articles that actually laid out the rationale for that, which are pure Keynesian, big government, solve it with money printing, could have been read by the White House staff, and maybe they would have recognized that he was the enemy, not the friend. And maybe they would have recognized he shouldn't have been appointed to the Fed, and after they appointed him to the Fed, he certainly shouldn't have been made chairman. But this was done by Republicans. So therefore, the three things that I've always believed in and that I talked about in my book in 1986, when I left the White House, I called it the triumph of politics, how the Reagan Revolution failed. By the way, I said failed. I didn't say succeeded. The three things I talked about in there, fiscal rectitude, free markets, and sound money, have all been abandoned by the Republican Party. They were never really believed in by the Democratic Party. And so now we have this little axis of the money printers that Wall Street loves because that fuels the speculation and the bubble, and the money printers at the Fed that Washington loves because they're making debt issuance so cheap that deficits in a practical sense don't matter. They say, we'll get to the problem tomorrow because they can borrow another $800 billion this year and pay rounding error cost on it. In other words, you can borrow three-year money today at 40 basis points. Now, when I say 40 basis points, a lot of you know that that's 0.4%. But I also point out that in Washington, they don't do decimal fractions very well. So when they hear 0.4, 40 basis points, they think it's free. And for all practical purposes, it is. So I say that the Fed has been the great enabler of the bipartisan folly of the massive national debt that we're creating and that's heading towards $30 trillion, not $17 trillion, over the next decade. And until we get honest interest rates, and until we get a free market that determines the supply and demand for savings and borrowing and what the interest rates really are in a free market, I think the whole thing is going to continue to drift. And that's why I call the budget a fiscal doomsday machine. No one's trying to stop it because they think we can go get by one more year with a little more borrowing, since it doesn't cost anything.
So there's two questions along the lines you've just answered. So does anybody in the political party have it right? Tea Party, Libertarians, does the two-party system work, or is there something else that we need to evolve to, and is there room for a third party? And what would that be?
My view, actually, and this is quite radical, is there's room for no parties. that in this day and age, I don't think parties are functional anymore. As I said, the parties are basically re-election machines. They're kind of, as I also said, glorified concierges. They organize money for campaigns. That's the thing they have in common. And their platforms are basically like, marketing slogans, but they really have very little to do with how people vote, how majorities are formed, how the country is governed. Now, I have proposed a radical constitutional amendment to say, and I know this can't happen, but it's a measure of how far we are from, let's call it functionality, that we should basically amend the Constitution and extend terms for 6 years for the House, the Senate, President. Second, say nobody can run for re-election, so I abolish incumbency. Now, when nobody can run for re-election, the minute they're sworn in, they do not have to spend a waking hour raising money, going to fundraisers, going to PACs, placating the lobbies and the special interests. If they want to get elected as a socialist and they can persuade their constituency, fine. If they want to get elected as a libertarian, fine too. But at least we'll have a battle of ideas and policy. They'll spend 6 years doing it, and then they go back to where they were elected from and go back to their previous way of life. It's citizen government. It would work now. We do not need a permanent governing class. We do not need a permanent political class. So, so that is kind of radical. And then I further say public money only in the campaigns the first time you run. Remember, there's no re-election, no incumbents. So in the first election anybody's in, we have an election every 2 years. We elect one-third, one-third, one-third. You have 8 weeks to campaign. You can only use public money. And all private money, PAC money, union money, corporation money, rich man money, or even just regular money is banned if it's private. And therefore, we clean up the election process entirely. We overturn Citizen United. And so, therefore, you can't use corporate money to lobby. Now, that's an omnibus amendment. And I want to tell you, it would liberate Washington from being a kind of the auction house that I think it is today. But I don't know how you get it done, because it's sort of like the mice who once all got together and said, you know, if we get a bell around this cat's neck, we'll all be safe. And I think that, you know, as citizens, we would all be safe if we could pass this omnibus amendment and abolish private money and abolish incumbency in our political process, turn the government back to citizens, have a real democracy. But I think, that is a tall order. It's difficult, but it's a measure of how far we've drifted. Right now, the system is run by money and PACs. There is no doubt about it, and therefore we drift. We're paralyzed. There's, dysfunctional family is what Washington really consists of.
Thank you. Now, how will the Fed unwind their balance sheet and avoid massive inflation?
So the question is, if you think the last one was a hard solution. On that, people have asked me the question, won't this lead to a great inflation? I don't think so. I think it's going to lead to a deflation of anything. I can give reasons in a second. But they then asked me, are you saying that none of these markets are safe, like ETFs or your favorite growth stock or, even bond funds and so forth? And I say, absolutely yes. All of them are part of this huge bubble that's inflating again on Wall Street. And when the next thing busts, just like last time, everything goes down in what's called 1.0 correlation. Everything goes down whether, it deserves it or not. The principle of market collapses, the principle of market drops like this is kind of expressed in this old saying about when the cops raid the house of ill repute, they carry out the good girls, the bad girls, and the piano player too. Now, what that means is when the market goes down, when this big correction comes, they're going to take everything with it. Therefore, I think it's not safe to be in these markets. You might make 2% if you own a bond fund, or 3%, or you might make a little more if the stock market goes up a little bit. But when the big decline comes, you'll lose 60 or 70%. That's what happens when we have these huge implosions of the bubble today. So then the question becomes, are you telling us to put our money under our mattress? And I say, now, wait a minute. You have really misunderstood me. I'm saying put your money in your mattress, okay, not under your mattress. But by that, I really mean put it in a safe, liquid place. You're going to be giving up, interim earnings, because I don't know when this is going to happen. It may take a year or 2 years or 3 years. But your capital will be safe. Whatever you've been, managed to save and accumulate will be safe in cash, because when the bond market, we're in the greatest bond bubble in history because it's all propped up by the Fed. When the bond bubble finally breaks, it'll cause a deflation in the economy, not an inflation. And as a result of that, I think cash is good. and cash will have exceedingly high value when these markets come unwound. So that would be the way I would look at it.
Well, thank you. I know after I finished reading the book, that's what I said to my husband. I'm converting everything to cash and sticking it in the mattress. A question on the budget. So what will it take for this country ever to pass a true balanced budget amendment to the Constitution?
A miracle.
No.
Okay. You know, I mean, it's a fair question, but, you know, if you look at really what they're saying today and you compare that to the size of the gap that we face, and I think it's, as I said, 15 to 20 trillion of new red ink, new national debt over the next 10 years, add it to the 17 that we've got, 17 trillion, that's about 30 trillion, 150% of GDP. It's a non-viable equation. Something will break before we get there. So why don't they do something about it? Because they're using rosy scenario to project an economy that gets better and better and grows at rates that we haven't seen for several decades and creates jobs at rates that haven't happened since the 1990s. And we're in a world where there's all kinds of headwinds. Japan, you know, is dropping into old age bankruptcy. China is a huge house of cards ready to collapse one of these days. They haven't discovered a miracle of perpetual growth. It's just a huge construction project and the biggest credit expansion that mankind has ever seen. Europe is unraveling, and the euro, sooner or later, I think, is going to fail. So with all those headwinds in the world, our economy is going to struggle to move forward, and therefore the projections they're making for the deficit coming down are not real because they assume an economy that we're never going to get to. So if you look at a real forecast for the budget for the next 10 years, and I don't even have to get pessimistic about it, I say let's do a cut-and-paste job, which means take the actual results of the economy for the last 10 years, the average growth rate, 1.7%. The average wage and salary growth rate, 3% nominal, negative in real terms. The average unemployment, interest, and so forth. Plug it all into this great budget forecasting machine, and you will see not a glide path down, but a slippery, you know, a banana peel and a huge explosion up. So therefore, you can't simply have pinpricks like Obama proposed today or a couple days ago that we're going to change the COLA for Social Security. That isn't nearly enough. That will save $100 billion, $130 billion over 10 years, 1% of the problem. You have to realize Social Security is a myth. The trust fund has nothing in it. It's kind of mythical accounting. It's actually a pay-as-you-go system. Right now, $50 billion a year is going out more than is coming in. And everything in the trust fund is essentially confetti. It's make-believe intergovernmental loans. There's no way to turn them into cash to make payments in the future unless the Treasury borrows more money or raises taxes in order to pay off the trust fund, so-called loans. So therefore, it's pretty obvious to me that you have a system that is so counterproductive for our society, and this is taking on, you know, sacred cows. The Social Security system and the myth that it's all fine, there's a trust fund, and it'll balance out, or if we have a problem, it's 30 years later, is so wrong. Because what it does is it keeps in place the payroll tax, so you have the liberals and the progressives saying we got to defend everything about Social Security, including the payroll tax, which is the biggest jobs destroyer in our economy. Because we take low-wage workers and we put 15% tax burden on them, half they pay out of their take-home, the other half their employer pays, and it reduces his incentive, obviously, to create jobs. So what we're doing is we're throwing the low-wage worker under the bus of this huge payroll tax in order to perpetuate the liberal myth that there's a trust fund and that Social Security is an insurance program when it's not. And we're using the money that we're taking out of the hide of the low-wage workers in America, or every wage worker for that matter, and we're running it through this pay-as-you-go system. And a substantial part of it, let me say, is going out to retirees who are affluent and have plenty of other means to support themselves in retirement, savings, pensions, investment income, and so forth. So we're basically hurting today's struggling entrance into the workforce with a tax that makes no sense, so that we can send it out to a bunch of old duffers who are down in Florida playing golf and collecting their Social Security check. Now, this is perverse, and yet the Republicans are afraid to take it on and tell the truth about it, and the Democrats pretend that this is one of the pillars of our social safety net, of our welfare state. It's not. The pillar of the welfare state is the means-tested programs for low-income people. Food stamps, that we need. Earned income tax credit, where you get additional money for the, if you got a minimum wage job, you're going to be able to get a tax credit and additional cash from the taxpayers because you're making an effort to support yourself. So what we're doing now is basically threatening to starve the safety net of means-tested programs for low income so we can perpetuate the myth of Social Security and Medicare for everybody and tax the low-wage worker in order to fund benefits to the high-income retiree. That is a massive policy error. That is why our system is so, in such trouble. But neither party will even talk about it in public. And that's part of the reason why they've denounced my book so much, because I actually mentioned that.
Thank you. And unfortunately, we've run out of time. I wanted to ask you, do you see anything positive going forward? I mean, we have good oil and gas reserves now in the U.S., and we're investing in corn. Red yeah. states are rising.
No, look, I see a positive that this society of ours has a longer tradition of self-government and freedom and liberty and people who are educated and people who are responsible and want to take care of themselves and people who are willing to sacrifice if they are only told the truth. But we're not liberating that great asset we have that's spread throughout Main Street America, coast to coast, because we have in Washington and in Wall Street a rigged game that benefits a very small slice of our society and leaves the rest of us floundering. And that is the dilemma that we're at. So I could be positive if I thought Main Street America could take back control of its government and could take back control of its financial life. But I don't see that happening, and therefore I'm kind of stuck in the middle in a dilemma, and I'm only trying to point out what some of the truths are that are being kept away from the public day in and day out. Thank you
so much. Our thanks to David Stockman, former budget director under President Ronald Reagan and author of the new book, The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. Today's program has been underwritten by the Corrett and Toby Family Foundations. We also want to remind everyone he has books out in the lobby that are for sale, and he's pleased to sign them in this room immediately following this program. I'm Evelyn Dilsaver, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Okay.